Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How does life change when you're called on to care for a loved one who is seriously ill? And what does it take to sustain the physical and emotional strength the task requires? The AARP estimates there are 65 million Americans providing some level of unpaid care to adult loved ones, and those responsibilities can be expected to last an average of 5 years. Many step in to provide aid and comfort without thinking twice, but over time and a series of transitions in the caregiving process come to realize that love and concern alone are not enough to keep them going. Author Gail Sheehy is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine. She explores the realities of caregiving and how families make it work in her newest book, Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. It's just come out in trade paperback. Gail, welcome to Think.
Happy to be with you.
So we all understand intellectually that we might very well be called on to do this at some point, but as you point out, nobody is ever quite expecting it. What do you think accounts for that?
Well, first of all, we're phobic about illness and aging and certainly death as Americans, probably more than anywhere else in the world. And so all of those thoughts begin to intrude when we think about, oh, my gosh, imagine my parents not being, you know, robust and traveling around the world and sending back pictures of themselves on riding camels. And what if my spouse, what if my partner in life suddenly needed care and wasn't the, you know, my stable helpmate. But in fact, it is one of the biggest and most universal crises of the 21st century because we're living an extra 30 years that were accrued over the last century. Our parents are moving into their high 80s and 90s. Our grandparents have already gotten there. And our spouses may have a prolonged life too, or they may actually, you know, they may have a health crisis, you know, suddenly. When this happens, it usually starts with the call, and almost none of us are prepared for it.
And
things can be, you know, quite chaotic right at the beginning because we really don't know how to deal with our fractured healthcare system. Not our fault. It's just the way it is out there.
Yeah. And for you, in fact, personally, this is not just something you researched as a journalist. You yourself got the call that changed your entire life when your husband was diagnosed with cancer.
Yes, I did. I was in a beauty shop getting ready to go to a concert with my husband, who was an editor, Clay Felker. And he was a very robust guy and had a powerful position and a big voice. And all of a sudden, this voice I didn't recognize was telling me it's not benign. And I said, well, wait a second. This is my husband's oncologist, I believe, but 2 years ago when you cut out the cyst on my husband's neck, you told us it was benign. He said, I know. The pathologist recut the old slides. It was cancer, and it's back. So suddenly, you know, I began to think, wait a minute, I had 9 months to prepare for the birth of my child, classes, training, all kinds of help from my family and friends. I had about 9 days to prepare for the dependence of my husband, and that lasted off and on for the next 17 years.
And one of the things that changes, as you alluded to earlier, is not only that you're suddenly in this position where you're learning all about the condition and what your husband needed or whatever loved one happens to be, but it changes the dynamic of your relationship in some ways.
Oh, in many ways, absolutely. But not, I would say, on balance, if you have a good marriage, on balance, it really brings you much, much closer together. There is a depth of bond and love and trust that naturally occurs because you're together fighting the threat to life, the threat to your life together, to the things you love to do. And if either one of you or both of you had any doubts that the other one loved you only for fill in the blank, you know, your position in life, your looks, your money, whatever, that is dispelled because nobody would stay in this situation if there wasn't true love for the individual.
What does it take?
And I want to just add there that, mm-hmm. that doesn't just apply if it's about a spouse. It also applies with parents. You know, given such a large and scattered American family, adult children are often not very close to their parents as they get older and maybe, you know, move to the South or somewhere else. And they may not or automatically answer the call because there's one child who still lives close to mom or dad and kind of takes it all on. But eventually, it's really essential that the whole family provides a circle of care, and not only for the benefit of the mom or dad, but for the benefit of the children who will otherwise carry a burden of guilt. And when that happens, there is a kind of, there's a fearless intimacy that can develop that is unlike anything you may have had with a parent before.
You base the book around 8 stages that caregivers tend to go through, and we'll talk about those individually in a minute, but it's worth mentioning the fact that unlike other stages of things that we experience in life, these don't present themselves necessarily in a linear fashion. You compare the path to something shaped like a labyrinth.
Well, yeah. You know, when I wrote my original book, Passages, I parsed the stages of adult development, and that was linear. You know, you go through, suddenly there's a crisis, you go through a passage, and then you emerge into a longer linear path in a new stage, and then things are quiet, and then there's another rough passage, and then you enter into another stage. Caregiving isn't anything like that. I tried to fit it into those brackets, but it didn't work.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was on a retreat for caregivers and began walking a labyrinth, you know, here you are going on a nice path, but then there's a sudden twist or turn, and you're walking again on a nice path, and suddenly another very abrupt turn. And then you're going in circles, and sometimes you double back, and you think, my God, I'm going backwards. Mm-hmm. And you're actually not. You're just going near territory you've covered before, but you know it better. And I began to say, oh, I know it. I understand now. Going through the passages of caregiving is like walking a labyrinth. And that is a spiritual exercise. It requires patience and faith because you can't see where you're going. And you can't really tell if it's going to bring you to the center and bring you back out. You have to have faith that it will. And it does.
So the first stage is shock and mobilization. I think people can imagine what that is like. After a really serious diagnosis, though, you stress the point that the caregiver and the patient need some time together to just sort of talk over what this all means.
Well, I don't know that you can do an awful lot of that in shock and mobilization because you're just trying to get through the day and do the research you need to do and talk to the doctors, and there will be multiple doctors involved in giving different treatment ideas and sometimes differing diagnoses. And it's very difficult to compare and select out of these different perspectives which way you think is the best way to go. So I say the most important thing to do is to pick out the doctor you most trust and feel comfortable with and ask if he or she will be your medical quarterback.
Mm-hmm.
To help you connect up all the players, build a team, pull it together, and then help you call the plays and come up with a treatment plan so that you feel some sense of control direction as to where you're going.
The internet, we know, is a wonderful and sometimes terrible thing. How do we learn to, as you put it, Google without freaking?
Well, first, you have to, I think, talk to the doctors. You don't really want to go in with a whole lot of Google information and give the doctors a hard time.
Yeah.
Give them a chance to tell you what they know about something that they confront every day. And then if once they start suggesting, you know, certain treatments or you want to know what the odds are, you want to check out that doctor. And I tell in the book exactly how to find you know, where that doctor's standing is and also the hospital that he or she may recommend for if there is you know, surgical treatment or hospital treatment required. The more they have done a procedure, the more likely they are going to be experienced with all the different ramifications that might come up. And then I think you find the most respected disease organization rely on them and develop a relationship with somebody that you could talk to on the other end of the line. Alzheimer's Association, I think, is the model. They have chapters in almost every part of the country, and you actually hook up with somebody who will come to the home of the patient and begin educating the patient and family about everything, whatever they can do to help you through the confusion of that diagnosis.
So after the initial shock, there's this reality of the new normal, that whatever was normal before, you're not going back to it anytime soon.
Right. Everybody else does. You may have had a lot of people rallying around and putting some of their lives on hold, but now there's a new normal, and it may mean that you have to restructure, your schedule in order to be on tap time to time to make sure that your loved one is following the protocol and doing well. And then, no sooner do you think, okay, I can handle this and we'll get through this. And it may go on for years. I mean, that could be a very lovely time. Mm-hmm. But eventually, most likely, if you're dealing with an older person, there will be a boomerang, another health crisis. But you're smarter now about how to galvanize. And this is a time when you really need to call a family meeting, because you, whoever you are, the primary caregiver, cannot do this alone. Nobody can. And yet so many women think, oh, well, it's just what we do, as a wife or as a daughter or a sister. But it's a professional-level role today. It requires many skills. It requires a great deal of confidence. It requires knowing how to talk to all these health professionals and get the kind of care and the support you need, and that is targeted to the wishes of the patient, not just to what medicine has to deliver. So this becomes a really important time to pull your siblings and other family members together. They may very well be resistant, or you might be, because you think, oh, no, this is just going to be a huge fight. Everybody's going to be, resistant, and old, roles and issues are going to come up, and the next thing you know, we're going to be fighting like we were fighting over the TV program to watch when we were seven. But in fact, what happens normally, especially if you do it around a nice occasion, somebody's anniversary or birthday, and it's a party, and everybody's in a good mood, and you say, well, let's talk about how we can help keep mom or dad independent as long as possible. All of us have some special skills or strengths that we can bring to the table. Let's talk about what each one of us could toss in here, how we could handle it. And the sooner you do it before there's a crisis, the better.
And it may be, as you mentioned, that, it doesn't have to be that someone is always driving mom to doctor's appointments and then the next person takes his or her turn. It could be that one person has a role in talking to the insurance companies, and one person has a role in making sure that, an ailing, let's say, parent is eating properly.
That's exactly right. Because, some people in the family have more money. Some people have more time, might be retired. Somebody's an accountant, knows how to, read the fine print on the insurance form, men very often prefer taking on the administrative responsibilities if mom or dad isn't great at paying bills or keeping track of things anymore. Somebody else is good at fix-it things and can come, periodically to, fix the screen door that's hanging off and do those repairs that make life go so much more smoothly.
My guest is author and contributing editor to Vanity Fair, Gail Sheehy. Her new book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. You can join the conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Gail Sheehy. Her new book, out now in trade paperback, is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. You can also send email to think@kera.org. Gail, obviously when someone we love dearly is seriously ill, there's a part of us that wants to drop everything and be there for every minute. And you point out the fact that this may not be sustainable over the long term, not only financially, but it may not be sustainable for the person providing the care.
Oh, right.
Can you talk about that?
Yes. This is one of the stages I found myself returning to from time to time, I call it playing God. You know, it's the most devoted caregivers who fall into this trap. You think you probably saved your loved one from something dangerous or even life-threatening if they've been in and out of hospitals. You begin to think that you're responsible for keeping your person safe or alive from day to day. And as long as that's working, you feel enormous satisfaction and your ego is stroked and you begin to really think you're almost like God. And eventually something is going to backfire. The treatment won't work or there's a recurrence. And if you're God and something goes wrong, guess whose fault it is?
You're responsible, yeah. Yeah. Or you feel that way anyway.
Well, you feel that way, and then you feel a total failure. And if it goes on too long playing God, it can become a very unhealthy codependent relationship. The person you're taking care of is likely to say, "Oh, I only trust my daughter," or "No, I don't want anybody else in the house. You know, just my son can come. That's it. Period." And I remember this one vivid case. I remember I was following this man for several years. He was taking care of his wife with MS. He'd given up his career, which he loved, and found another way to make a living from home so he could be around all the time. And he just refused the idea of hiring anybody to, you know, give him time off. And he didn't have any siblings, and they had no children. After 10 years of this, he finally broke down and hired somebody to come in on the weekends. He went out and got in his car on a Saturday morning, and he sat there looking at the garage. He couldn't remember what he liked to do. So he didn't really remember who he was. You don't want to get there. It's hard to come back from there. You can, but you shouldn't get there in the first place.
Do men and women approach this process in different ways?
Oh, of course, as we do most everything.
Yeah.
Women most often provide the hands-on care. I guess we're more physically accustomed to taking care of babies and taking care of, you know, people who are messy and who have messy illnesses and accidents. But men can be extremely helpful. They tend to step back and look at the larger picture, and they like to do administrative things. They like to be the one that calls the insurance company or the hospital and, you know, argues out a bill, goes over the finances and sees how things can be structured in such a way that nobody is going to be really caught out. And let them do that. But it's also important to bring them in to actually have some physical contact with a parent or certainly a loved one. And I do know a number of men who've taken care of their wives. And they think, oh, my God, I couldn't possibly, you know, change a colostomy bag or deal with a feeding tube or take her to chemo and, you know, see her come out all, you know, and maybe vomit. But they do. And I tell you, it's a real exercise in humility and patience and faith. And I know a lot of men who have done it and done it really admirably.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. My guest this hour is Gail Sheehy. Her new book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Let's speak to Gordon in Dallas. Hi, Gordon.
Hi. This is Gordon from Dallas.
Hello.
Hello.
And I wish I'd had this book about a year ago. I'm sorry, I don't know if I can do this. My partner died, and I was the sole caregiver throughout. about the last 5 years, well, his whole life, but 5 years and the last couple of months were especially difficult because it was just hard to go through. But one of the difficulties I find is that the gay community doesn't have much a support system for this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. You have your friends, but you do pretty much go through it alone.
Yeah.
And your book would have been very, very important for me to read, to know what to expect.
Well, Gordon, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I appreciate you calling. Can you talk about that, Gail, different sort of communities that come together or don't come together in these situations?
Well, you know, it's surprising to me that gay community doesn't have a support system because it was the model of a support system during through the height of the AIDS crisis. But this one may just be kept under wraps. Perhaps people don't like to acknowledge that somebody is really ill, and or the person who's ill doesn't want it acknowledged. So they may not know. But there are more and more communities are coming up with novel ways to reach out and help caregivers. But people don't really know about it. There's no umbrella organization that lets you know where in your community you might reach out. And these kinds of organizations, I just was speaking to one at one in Philadelphia, speaking to another one in Northwest Arkansas, if you can imagine. But they have one of the most progressive community programs. And what these organizations do, and they're almost all nonprofits funded by, you know, grants, gifts, foundations, is to offer a care manager, somebody you can call, make an appointment with, go in for at least a half an hour, tell or go in with your loved one and say, here's the situation. You know, here's the kind of help we need. Here's what the prognosis looks like or how things are going to shape up over the next year or two. What would you suggest? Who would you send us to? Do we need to hire somebody? Can we go out on the gray market? You know, how much help do we need? How soon will we need more, et cetera? Because once you have a team, it's not only, you know, saves the sanity and the health of the caregiver, which otherwise inevitably suffers. It is much more stimulating to the patient. Hmm. I remember, you know, when I was in my playing God phase, my husband, you know, was dying to have somebody he could talk sports with. You know, I don't know the NFL from the NBA. And I finally hired a young man who was a coach, a sports coach, and he would come and take my husband out, and they'd go to the park, and they'd talk sports, and they'd racket around town, and they'd, you know, go to a museum, go to a zoo. He'd spend 4 hours with him, and he just had a ball.
Yeah.
It made a whole difference in his attitude.
Something you're really candid about here that I think is fascinating is that you recognized after a time that it was an important source of strength and renewal for you to keep working. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Oh, yes. I think it's, if it's at all possible for the caregiver to keep working, gives you, you know, it renews your source of identity day by day. Because the identity of wife or husband or even daughter or son is changing quite radically as a person becomes more ill or more dependent, whereas your work identity is something you want to continue to build. You need that structure, that stability, those colleagues. You need to see people during the day, think about other things. You can keep in really good touch now through all the different electronic means we have, and, you know, even with Skype. And interestingly, you have much more to bring back to the person at home at the end of the day that, you know, revives you all both for over dinner and through the evening. So even if you're working part-time, it's really important to try to keep that position. And that's one of the things you need to tell your siblings, mm-hmm. That, you know, I don't want to, you know, retreat into being an unpaid home health caregiver for an unspecified period of time, I don't think that'll be good for me or good for my children or good for my marriage or good for my partnership. And I need your help to either, you know, let's all put some money in so we can hire some outside people to supplement.
How candid should you be or must you be with the person for whom you're caring? And we'll set aside dementia and illnesses that really affect people's ability to think. But how candid can you be with the person you're caring for about the stresses that you're undergoing? Is it important to sort of protect that person from any sense that this is not all perfect for everyone surrounding them?
I don't think it's humanly possible to protect them from that because, you know, you're going to have really bad days. You're going to say things you wish you hadn't. You know, you're going to, I can remember sometimes just saying, I don't know what to do for you anymore. You know, mm-hmm. I'm lost. So I think having, you know, telling what I finally did when I was not going back to work, towards the end of my husband's, illnesses, I was offered to write a story about the 2008 presidential election, and I turned it down. I said, I can't possibly leave my husband now. He's just too needy. And his own doctor, a palliative care doctor from Mount Sinai, said, Gail, you have to go. This is an unhealthy, codependent relationship that is building here. You have to be who you are. You're beginning to lose who you are. Mm-hmm. You're a writer. And he said, the way I'm going to prove this to you is we're going to have a talk at your husband's bedside, and we're going to see if we get his blessing. And we had my daughters and my sister and doctor, and as soon as the doctor laid out the question, my husband said, of course I want you to go. Just send me back the gossip. And he enjoyed it as much as I did, actually.
Mm-hmm. And you did some traveling as well with your husband fairly far into the progress of his disease.
I didn't get the first part of your question.
You and your husband did travel. You continued traveling together for quite some time.
Yes, we did. And under circumstances that some people might find, you know, off-putting. And we didn't. He had a feeding tube mm-hmm. that was going to become permanent because of radiation damage in his neck. And we kind of hung inside the house for 6 months, and summer was coming on, and I said, gee, this is really a bore. Why don't we just try going to Paris for a week? You know, we need to see something different. And my husband said, how can you possibly do that? You know, you have to boil down all the food and then blenderize it and then strain it and then, you know, pour it through into this little tiny tube that's less than a dime's diameter. I said, well, why don't we just go to Paris and get a blender in French Current and see what happens? Mm-hmm. And we took a long transatlantic flight, and when we were standing on the curbside waiting for a taxi at Charles de Gaulle, my husband was leaning on me and feeling humiliated to be that weak, and I thought, oh, my God, I've done the worst possible thing to take somebody in his condition who couldn't eat on the whole flight on this long trip. But the next morning, I went out and foraged for a wonderful French breakfast and brought it back in and put it through the blender. And then after putting in the food and the fruit, I put in a cafe au lait, and then I put in my cafe au lait. And suddenly my husband jumped up and said, let's go to the Louvre. And he was all bright-eyed and bushy-tailed, and being in a new environment brought him back a lot. And then the late afternoon, I said, well, we don't want to sit in the hotel room for dinner. So I looked around for a small and pretentious cafe and found one and took the blender in and asked if I could speak to the chef. And he came out, a nice young Frenchman, and I explained our situation. And he said, you know, Monsieur cannot taste my food. Quel dommage. And I said, no, but he can smell it, mm-hmm. and he can see it, and he can enjoy the ambiance of your lovely restaurant and being with me, and that would mean a great deal to us. Could you accommodate us? And he said, oh, avec plaisir, and went off to do this. And we came back at 7 that night. They seated us in a discreet part of the cafe, And eventually he sent out two waiters with silver trays, with silver pitchers on them, with the first course and the second course. And they stood there while Clay poured his meal and had. Then they came out with a little dessert, a little creme fraiche with berries on top, and that was able to. Clay was able to let that melt on his tongue. We had a glass of wine. It was the most romantic evening we'd had in a long, long time. And what we learned from that was that normal is as normal does.
Mm-hmm.
And from then on, we were fearless about eating at friends' homes, having them to our home, going to a restaurant or a cafe, as long as I spoke to the manager or the chef beforehand. And I never had anybody who wasn't more than happy to accommodate us.
My guest is Gail Sheehy. Her new book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. We have an email here, Gail, from Rachel in Waxahachie, who says, my partner and I are mothers of a permanently disabled child. What advice do you have in dealing with the obstacles of rearing and caring for a disabled child, and is it that much different than caring for an adult?
Well, I think it is, sure. Just like caring for a spouse is quite different than caring for a parent.
Mm-hmm.
But again, this becomes the necessity for a circle of care is, again, very important. And there may be, I would think, a group in your community of parents of similar of other disabled children, or you can put together a group where maybe you can get together at some points where there can be a kind of playtime with a number of children, and you have a chance to, you know, socialize with other parents in a similar situation, but also trading off sometimes for respite, because respite is essential for anybody taking care of a person who is chronically ill or disabled. Otherwise, we're hypervigilant all the time, and that means these stress hormones are running around our circulatory system all the time, and that is very deleterious to our health long term. And it's not you know, unusual for a caregiver to die before the person they're taking care of.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. Gail Sheehy is my guest. Her new book is called Passages in Caregiving. We'll return in just a couple of minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed graduate program that allows you the chance to meet the challenges of society. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Gail Sheehy. Her newest book is called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. We haven't talked very much this hour, Gail, about money, but this is a real issue for a lot of American families, making this care available with limited resources. Can you talk about what you learned?
Well, it comes as a shock to most people in their 40s and 50s, boomers who are taking care of parents, that Medicare does not provide for long-term care, no money at all. A few weeks of routine visits by a physical therapist and perhaps a speech therapist, but then it's all on you. And to hire people from an agency, there are a lot of restrictions. The agency home health aides can't do very much. They're restricted. And they only make about $9 an hour, although the agency may charge you $15. And you have to tap them for 8 hours a day. You may not need one for 8 hours a day. So that's not often satisfactory. What I found is going out on the gray market, which is in every community, there are some immigrant groups who are often quite well trained from their home country, as nurses or as aides or as caregivers for their own family members. And you can hire them and pay them a decent wage, and they're often very, very happy to do such a spiritually satisfying kind of work. But it is a huge hit, and studies have shown that families who have to do long-term care for any real length of time. And we're talking years and possibly even more than a decade if you're talking about cognitive decline, often lose their home or, you know, lose their own savings, and then who's going to take care of them? So what communities are now doing is trying to find the best sources of volunteers and of home health aides who are self-employed, who can offer better care and without the intermediary of an agency, may be paid a decent wage and be faithful and reliable in coming for the amount of time that you need.
So long-term care insurance is a good investment for most families, do you think?
I don't know that. Only 9% of Americans have long-term care, so they must have looked at it and said this is either too expensive or I don't know if it's going to be if it's going to be good enough for what I need when I get there, because there's a lot of fine print there. What you really want to be able to have is somebody, you really want to have a team if you begin to get quite sick, chronically ill.
Mm-hmm.
Here's the big problem in our medical, in our healthcare system as I see it. If you know, our hospitals are quite good at curing acute illness, short-term acute illness. But when it comes to chronic illness, which is where most of us are going to wind up because we're so good at arresting major serious illnesses like cancer or stroke or heart disease or diabetes or even the autoimmune diseases in the beginning. But then they usually repeat and they recur, they come back. And then you can't be cured in an acute care hospital. And going in and out all the time through an ambulance and then hospital stay, and then you're off at a rest center and at rehab and then back home and then around the revolving door again, that's debilitating
mm-hmm.
for older people. And it's very expensive. And it's why our health care costs go through the roof. I think it's the major reason. But that's the way the reimbursement system has been set up. And that really has to change. And I think the wave of the future is what we found as our saving grace towards in the last 2 years of my husband's life is palliative care. Palliative care is not like hospice. Hospice is a wonderful program, but it's for people who are not going to live longer than 6 months. And that's the rule under Medicare. You also have to give up any treatment. So most people see that as a giving up, and they don't really choose to do it until the last few weeks or the last few hours or even the last hour before and when it could have been helpful. Palliative care is about supporting the patient and family through in living with chronic illness with the best quality of life possible. You can have continue medical treatment as long as it makes the person more comfortable. You can go out. You're not in an institution. Your family can be around, and there's no deadline. So it is a wonderful alternative to people who do not want to spend their last years or months in a hospital.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to Susan in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hi. I love your show, Chris.
Thank you.
And, Gail, I've read some of your books, not this one, but I think I need to get it because I've been living this scenario for the last year. My younger sister was, who lives in Ohio, I live here in Dallas, she was diagnosed with stage 3 inflammatory breast cancer, a very aggressive form that has not responded well to the surgery or any of the FDA-approved chemotherapies, radiation, et cetera. And since I had lost my job 2 weeks before she was diagnosed and was, you know, I don't want to say a high-powered business person, but very, you know, methodical, you know, dog with a bone kind of person, my whole family just turned en masse and looked at me and said, ooh, you need to kind of get involved in all that medical advocacy insurance kind of stuff. And I've pretty much done nothing but that, and it baffles me how anyone as seriously ill as my sister or anyone with an illness like this can deal with the massive amounts of paperwork and the frustration of filing and fighting insurance claims and just researching clinical trials and what to try next, because if you're waiting for the doctors to do that, some of them are just, they've got a lot of sick patients and they're just not able to focus step by step what's next. So I've been doing a lot of that, trying to stay ahead of things, working with her mortgage company so she doesn't lose her home, and with a million agencies just trying to get financial assistance, and there are so many and they're all wonderful, but it's just been like a major research project, and it is exhausting. I don't know how sick people are supposed to do it.
Well, you've given a very vivid picture of what caregivers do have to do. It is a major research program, and particularly if you don't have good language skills, it's really difficult. Do you have any? Are there any other members of the family who can take some of it off your hands? And
well, actually, yes, and I certainly am not painting myself as the standalone person here. My sister has a wonderful support group up in Ohio. They will stop by with food, or they'll take her to her chemotherapies, etc. But when it comes to any of the paperwork, I've been dealing with Social Security, disability. She has next to no money. She can't work any longer. Just trying to find a clinical trial that's not, somewhere where you have to move. That's the other thing. You find a trial that might work. If it's in New York or Boston, you've got to get a hotel and stay there, or an apartment. And so it's really pretty challenging pulling all those pieces together, and that's kind of my job. The family looks to me to do that sort of thing, all that tedious paperwork, disability, just the follow-up.
Yeah.
And they do the one-on-one visits. I get up as often as I can, and especially if she does one of her major follow-ups with a new oncologist or to see how treatment is going. But if I hear that it's not going well, then I'm right back in looking for the next trial, because you have to stay ahead of it
right.
So that you can fill out all the paperwork, send in all the CDs of all the PET scans and MRIs and doctor's notes, so that when they say, I'm sorry, this treatment isn't working, we have to suspend it, you don't waste 6 weeks with no treatment while the cancer is ravaging you, looking for the next one. And it just, sometimes my family even jumps on me and they go, you're like rabid.
Yeah.
You need to take a chill pill.
I would say one thing that I find is the single greatest help when you're in such a race as you are is a care manager. A care manager, which is private hire. You could go on the AARP website and put in your zip code, and you'll find the ones in your area or in your sister's area. They will do a consult over the phone for free, and then if you find somebody you feel is gets it about where your sister is, they can decode an awful lot of what you're going through. It's like having a fixer in the old Soviet Union. They know the language, they know the barricades, they know the secret code words to get the help you need, or to put the other party on notice that you're on to the game. And just to give you the directions on how to proceed at this crisis juncture is worth the money. It will save you an enormous amount of time and money down the line, so that you're not, your time isn't completely eaten up doing this when I assume you also are holding down a job.
Gail, what does it take to another sort of stage that you talk about is recognizing that while your loved one remains ill or may, in certain cases, die, that your life is going to go on, and to sort of come to terms with, I don't know if it's survivor guilt or just a sense of being sort of hung up on that issue?
I think the most important turning for the caregiver is what I call coming back.
Mm-hmm.
Coming back means, at the point at which you recognize that your loved one is probably not going to come back to the independent person they were, they might not die, but they may be permanently in chronic illness. You need to be on a different path. You can't continue to be so wrapped up in the case and in the fighting it that you forget who you are. I can tell you, I just had an experience with this. The person who was the administrator of the organization that I was speaking for the other day in Northwest Kansas And suddenly she got up in the middle of my talk, and I saw her leave, and later she told me why. She had cared for her father long-term, then her mother-in-law, and no sooner had those caregiving crises passed than her pregnant daughter was killed in a car accident, and her grandson was left in a vegetative state, and she took care of him at his home, or in her home, for 6 years. And she had finally come back out of that and gotten a job at this wonderful nonprofit, but she really didn't have, her marriage had kind of gone into slumber, and she left to go call her husband and say, we have to talk. We have to redefine who we are. We've lost who we are. So you don't want to get that far, and thank goodness she heard something that was a trigger for her. So what I say is you have to begin, you know, going out. You have to go out into the world. You have to reconnect with your friends or build new ones by joining groups, by going to a health club, by going on a respite trip for a week. Get somebody to come and stay with your loved one so you go away for a week and you don't, you know, they can reach you if there's an emergency, but if they don't have to, you don't call in every night. You really need that rest and recovery for yourself. And then you need to reconnect with your passions, your transports to joy, whether it's, you know, fixing up antique cars or singing in a church choir or doing aerobics, whatever it is that gives you pleasure and takes you out of the caregiving role for at least an hour every day is absolutely essential for you to live through this long-term role and come out of it healthy enough to go on with your own life.
In the 30 seconds or so we have left, Gail, what can those of us who are not currently acting as caregivers do for our friends and colleagues and distant relatives who are?
Well, when you know of a situation like this, it's a great thing to, you know, call up or best to call up or send an email and just say, give me one specific thing that I can do to help. You know, send me to pick up something, you know, tell me to research something, tell me to bring something that would bring, you know, a little light into the day of your loved one. I'm here, but I need help to know what I can do. They will be very, very, very grateful and never forget.
Author Gail Sheehy is a contributing editor to Vanity Fair magazine and author of the new book available now in trade paperback called Passages in Caregiving, Turning Chaos into Confidence. Gail, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.